on those towers? I don't. Are they hiding, sir? I saw these sons of the Harpy today, all their proud high-born warriors. They dressed in linen skirts, and the fiercest thing about them was their hair. Even a modest Khalasar could crack this astapor like a nut and spill out the rotted meat inside. So tell me, why is that ugly Harpy not sitting beside the god's way in Vaes Dothrak, among the other stolen gods?
You have a dragon's eye, Khaleesi. That's plain to see.
I wanted an answer, not a compliment.
There are two reasons. Astapor's brave defenders are so much chaff, it's true. Old names and fat purses who dress up as Gaskari scourges to pretend they still rule a vast empire. Everyone is a high officer. On feast days, they fight mock wars in the pits to demonstrate what brilliant commanders they are. But it's the eunuchs who do the dying. All the same, any enemy wanting to sack Astapor would have to know that they'd be facing the Unsullied. The slavers would turn out the whole garrison in the city's defense. The Dothraki have not ridden against Unsullied since they left their braids at the gates of Kohor.
And the second reason? Danny asked.
Who would attack Astapor? Sir Jorah asked. Meereen and Yunkai are rivals, but not enemies. The Doom destroyed Valeria. The folk of the eastern hinterlands are all Giskari, and beyond the hills lies Lazar, the Lamb Men, as your Dothraki call them, a notably unwarlike people.
Yes, she agreed, but north of the slave cities is the Dothraki Sea, and 24 mighty Karls who like nothing more than sacking cities and carrying off their people into slavery.
Carrying them off where? What good are slaves once you've killed the slavers? Valeria is no more. Karth lies beyond the Red Waste, and the 9 free cities are thousands of leagues to the west. And you may be sure, the sons of the Harpy give lavishly to every passing Karl, just as the magisters do in Pentos and Norvas and Myr. They know that if they feast the horse lords and give them gifts, they will soon ride on. It's cheaper than fighting, and a deal more certain.
Cheaper than fighting, Danny thought. Yes, it might be. If only it could be that easy for her. How pleasant it would be to sail to King's Landing with her dragons and pay the boy Joffrey a chest of gold to make him go away. Khaleesi, Sir Jorah prompted, when she had been silent for a long time. He touched her elbow lightly. Danny shrugged him off. Viserys would have bought as many Unsullied as he had coin for. But you once said I was like Rhaegar. I remember, Daenerys. Your grace, she corrected. Prince Rhaegar led free men into battle, not slaves. Whitebeard said he dubbed his squires himself, and made many other knights as well.
There was no higher honour than to receive your knighthood from the Prince of Dragonstone.
Tell me, then. When he touched a man on the shoulder with his sword, what did he say? Go forth and kill the weak, or go forth and defend them. At the Trident, those brave men Viserys spoke of, who died beneath our dragon banners, did they give their lives because they believed in Rhaegar's cause, or because they had been bought and paid for? Danny turned to Mormont, crossed her arms, and waited for an answer.
"My queen," the big man said slowly, "all you say is true. But Rhaegar lost on the Trident. He lost the battle. He lost the war. He lost the kingdom. And he lost his life. His blood swirled downriver with the rubies from his breastplate, and Robert the Usurper rode over his corpse to steal the Iron Throne. Rhaegar fought valiantly. Rhaegar fought nobly. Rhaegar fought honorably. And Rhaegar died."
Bran. No roads ran through the twisted mountain valleys where they walked now. Between the grey stone peaks lay still blue lakes, long and deep and narrow, and the green gloom of endless piney woods. The russet and gold of autumn leaves grew less common when they left the Wolf's Wood to climb amongst the old flint hills, and vanished by the time those hills had turned to mountains. Giant grey-green sentinels loomed above them now, and spruce and fir and soldier pines in endless profusion. The undergrowth was sparse beneath them, the forest floor carpeted in dark green needles. When they lost their way, as happened once or twice, they need only wait for a clear, cold night when the clouds did not intrude, and look up in the sky for the ice dragon. The blue star in the dragon's eye pointed the way north, as Usher told him once. Thinking of Usher made Bran wonder where she was. He pictured her safe in White Harbor with Rickon and Shaggy Dog, eating eels and fish and hot crab pie with fat Lord Manderley. Or maybe they were warming themselves at the last hearth before the great John's fires. But Bran's life had turned into endless, chilly days on Hodor's back, riding his basket up and down the slopes of mountains. "Up and down," Mira would sigh sometimes as they walked, "then down and up, then up and down again. I hate these stupid mountains of yours, Prince Bran."
"Yesterday you said you loved them." "Oh, I do. My lord father told me about mountains, but I never saw one till now. I love them more than I can say."
Bran made a face at her.
"But you just said you hated them."
"Why can't it be both?"
Mira reached up to pinch his nose.
"Because they're different," he insisted, "like night and day, or ice and fire." "If ice can burn," said Jojen in his solemn voice, "then love and hate can mate. Mountain or marsh, it makes no matter. The land is one."
"One," his sister agreed, "but over-wrinkled."
The High Glen seldom did them the courtesy of running north and south. So often they found themselves going long leagues in the wrong direction, and sometimes they were forced to double back the way they'd come.
"If we took the King's Road, we could be at the wall by now,"
Bran would remind the Reeds. He wanted to find the three-eyed crow, so he could learn to fly. Half a hundred times he said it if he said it once, until Mira started teasing by saying it along with him.
"If we took the King's Road, we wouldn't be so hungry either,"
he started saying then. Down in the hills they'd had no lack of food. Mira was a fine huntress, and even better at taking fish from streams with her three-pronged frog spear. Bran liked to watch her, admiring her quickness, the way she sent the spear lancing down and pulled it back with a silvery trout wriggling on the end of it. And they had Summer hunting for them as well. The direwolf vanished most every night as the sun went down, but he was always back again before dawn, most often with something in his jaws, a squirrel or a hare. But here, in the mountains, the streams were smaller and more icy, and the game scarcer. Mira still hunted and fished when she could, but it was harder, and some nights even Summer found no prey. Often they went to sleep with empty bellies. But Jojen remained stubbornly determined to stay well away from roads.
"Where you find roads, you find travellers," he said in that way he had. "And travellers have eyes to see, and mouths to spread tales of the crippled boy, his giant, and the wolf that walks beside them."
No one could get as stubborn as Jojen. So they struggled on through the wild, and every day climbed a little higher and moved a little farther north. Some days it rained, some days were windy, and once they were caught in a sleet storm, so fierce that even Hodor bellowed in dismay. On the clear days it often seemed as if they were the only living things in all the world.
"Does no one live up here?"
Mira asked once, as they made their way around a granite upthrust as large as Winterfell.
There's people, Bran told her. The Umbers are mostly east of the King's Road, but they graze their sheep in the high meadows in summer. There are Walls west of the mountains along the Bay of Ice, Harclays back behind us in the hills, and Knots and Liddles and Norries, and even some Flints up here in the high places.
His father's mother's mother had been a Flint of the mountains. Old Nan once said that it was her blood in him that made Bran such a fool for climbing before his fall. She had died years and years and years before he was born, though, even before his father had been born.
"Wall," said Mira, "Jojun, wasn't there a Wall who rode with father during the war?"
"Theo, Wall." Jojun was breathing hard from the climb. "Buckets, they used to call him."
"That's their sigil," said Bran. "Three brown buckets on a blue field with a border of white and grey checks. Lord Wall came to Winterfell once to do his fealty and talk with father, and he had the buckets on his shield. He's no true lord, though. Well, he is, but they call him just the Wall. And there's the Knot and the Norrie and the Liddle, too. At Winterfell, we call them lords, but their own folk don't."
Jojen stopped to catch his breath. "Do you think these mountain folk know we're here?"
"They know."
Bran had seen them watching, not with his own eyes, but with Summer's sharper ones, that missed so little.
"They won't bother us so long as we don't try and make off with their goats or horses."
Nor did they. Only once did they encounter any of the mountain people, when a sudden burst of freezing rain sent them looking for shelter. Summer found it for them, sniffing out a shallow cave behind the grey-green branches of a towering sentinel tree. But when Hodor ducked beneath the stony overhang, Bran saw the orange glow of fire farther back and realized they were not alone.
"Come in and warm yourselves," a man called out. "There's stone enough to keep the rain off all our heads."
He offered them oatcakes and blood sausage and a swallow of ale from a skin he carried, but never his name, nor did he ask theirs. Bran figured him for a Liddle. The clasp that fastened his squirrel skin cloak was gold and bronze and wrought in the shape of a pine cone, and the Liddles bore pine cones on the white half of their green and white shields.
"Is it far to the wall?" Bran asked him, as they waited for the rain to stop.
"Not so far as a raven flies," said the Liddle, if that was who he was. "Farther for them as lax wings."
Bran started.
"I'd bet we'd be there if we took the King's Road,"
Mira finished with him. The Liddle took out a knife and whittled at a stick.
"When there was a Stark in Winterfell, a maiden girl could walk the King's Road in her name-day gown and still go unmolested, and travellers could find fire, bread, and salt at many an inn and holdfast. But the nights are colder now, and doors are closed. There's squids in the Wolfswood, and flayed men ride the King's Road asking after strangers."
The reeds exchanged a look.
"Flayed man," said Jojen. "The bastard's boys, aye. He was dead, but now he's not. And paying good silver for wolfskins, a man is, and maybe gold, for word of certain other walking dead."
He looked at Bran when he said that, and at Summer stretched out beside him.
"As to that wall," the man went on, "it's not a place that I'd be going. The old bear took the watch into the haunted woods, and all that come back was his ravens, with hardly a message between them. Dark wings, dark words, me mother used to say. But when the birds fly silent, seems to me that's even darker."
He poked at the fire with his stick.
"It was different when there was a Stark in Winterfell, but the old wolf's dead, and young ones gone south to play the Game of Thrones, and all that's left us is the ghosts. The wolves will come again, said Joe John solemnly. And how would ye be knowing that, boy?
I dreamed it.
Some nights I dream of me mother that I buried 9 years past, the man said. But when I wake, she's not come back to us.
There are dreams and dreams, my lord.
Hodor, said Hodor.
They spent that night together, for the rain did not let up till well past dark, and only Summer seemed to want to leave the cave. When the fire had burned onto embers, Bran let him go. The direwolf did not feel the damp, as people did, and the night was calling him. Moonlight painted the wet woods in shades of silver and turned the grey peaks white. Owls hooted through the dark and flew silently between the pines, while pale goats moved along the mountainsides. Bran closed his eyes and gave himself up to the wolf dream, to the smells and sounds of midnight. When they woke the next morning, the fire had gone out, and the Liddell was gone. But he left a sausage for them and a dozen oat cakes folded up neatly in a green and white cloth. Some of the cakes had pine nuts baked in them, and some had blackberries. Bran ate one of each, and still did not know which sort he liked the best. One day there would be Starks in Winterfell again, he told himself, and then he'd send for the Liddells and pay them back 100-fold for every nut and berry. The trail they followed was a little easier that day, and by noon the sun came breaking through the clouds. Bran sat in his basket up on Hodor's back and felt almost content. He dozed off once, lulled to sleep by the smooth swing of the big stable boy's stride and the soft humming sound he made sometimes when he walked. Mira woke him with a light touch on his arm.
"Look," she said, pointing at the sky with her frog spear. "An eagle!"
Bran lifted his head and saw it, its grey wings spread and still as it floated on the wind. He followed it with his eyes as it circled higher, wondering what it would be like to soar above the world so effortless. Better than climbing, even. He tried to reach the eagle, to leave his stupid, crippled body and rise into the sky to join it, the way he joined with Summer.
The greenseers could do it. I should be able to do it, too.
He tried and tried until the eagle vanished in the golden haze of the afternoon.
"It's gone," he said, disappointed.
"We'll see others," said Mira. "They live up here."
"I suppose."
"Hodor," said Hodor.
"Hodor," Bran agreed.
Jojun kicked a pinecone.
"Hodor likes it when you say his name, I think."
"Hodor's not his true name," Bran explained. "It's just some word he says. His real name is Walder. Old Nan told me. She was his grandmother's grandmother or something."
Talking about old Nan made him sad.
"Do you think the Iron Men killed her?"
They hadn't seen her body at Winterfell. He didn't remember seeing any women dead, now that he thought back.
"She never hurt no one, not even Theon. She just told stories. Theon wouldn't hurt someone like that, would he?"
"Some people hurt others just because they can," said Jojen. "And it wasn't Theon who did the killing at Winterfell," said Mira. "Too many of the dead were Iron Men."
She shifted her frog spear to her other hand.
"Remember old Nan's stories, Bran? Remember the way she told them? The sound of her voice? So long as you do that, part of her will always be alive in you."
"I'll remember," he promised. They climbed without speaking for a long time, following a crooked game trail over the high saddle between two stony peaks. Scrawny soldier pines clung to the slopes around them. Far ahead, Bran could see the icy glitter of a stream where it tumbled down a mountainside. He found himself listening to Jojen's breathing and the crunch of pine needles under Hodor's feet.
"Do you know any stories?" he asked the reeds all of a sudden.
Mira laughed. Oh, a few.
A few, her brother admitted.
Hodor, said Hodor, humming.
You could tell one, said Bran, while we walked. Hodor likes stories about knights. I do, too.
There are no knights in the neck, said Jojen.
Above the water, his sister corrected. The bugs are full of dead ones, though.
That's true, said Jojen. Andals and Iron Men, Freys and other fools, all those proud warriors who set out to conquer Greywater. Not one of them could find it. They ride into the neck, but not back out. And sooner or later, they blunder into the bogs and sink beneath the weight of all that steel and drown there in their armor.
The thought of drowned knights under the water gave Bran the shivers. He didn't object, though. He liked the shivers.
There was one night, said Mira, in the year of the false spring, the Knight of the Laughing Tree, they called him. He might have been a Crannog man, that one.
Or not.
Jojen's face was dappled with green shadow.
Prince Bran has heard that tale 100 times, I'm sure.
No, said Bran, I haven't. And if I have, it doesn't matter. Sometimes old Nan would tell the same story she'd told before, but we never minded if it was a good story. Old stories are like old friends, she used to say. You have to visit them from time to time.
That's true.
Mira walked with her shield on her back, pushing an occasional branch out of the way with her frog spear. Just when Bran began to think that she wasn't going to tell the story after all, she began.
Once there was a curious lad who lived in the neck. He was small, like all Crannog men, but brave and smart and strong as well. He grew up hunting and fishing and climbing trees and learned all the magics of my people.
Bran was almost certain he'd never heard the story.
Did he have green dreams like Jojen?
No, said Mira, but he could breathe mud and run on leaves and change earth to water and water to earth with no more than a whispered word. He could talk to trees and weave words and make castles appear and disappear.
Well, I wish I could, Bran said plaintively. When does he meet the tree knight?
Mira made a face at him.
Sooner, if a certain prince would be quiet.
I was just asking.
The lad knew the magics of the Crannog, she continued, but he wanted more. Our people seldom travel far from home, you know. We're a small folk, and our ways seem queer to some, so the big people do not always treat us kindly. But this lad was bolder than most, and one day, when he had grown to manhood, he decided he would leave the Crannogs and visit the Isle of Faces.
No one visits the Isle of Faces, objected Bran. That's where the green men live.
It was the green men he meant to find. So he donned a shirt sewn with brun scales, like mine, took up a leathern shield and a 3-pronged spear, like mine, and paddled a little skin boat down the Green Fork.
Bran closed his eyes to try and see the man in his little skin boat. In his head, the Crannog man looked like Jojen, only older and stronger, and dressed like Mira.
He passed beneath the twins by night so the Freys would not attack him, and when he reached the Trident, he climbed from the river and put his boat on his head and began to walk. It took him many a day, but finally he reached the God's Eye, threw his boat in the lake, and paddled out to the Isle of Faces.
Did he meet the green men?
Yes, said Mira, but that's another story, and not for me to tell. My prince asked for knights.
Green men are good, too.
They are,
she agreed, but said no more about them.
All that winter, the Crannog man stayed on the isle, but when the spring broke, he heard the wide world calling, and knew the time had come to leave. His skin boat was just where he'd left it, so he said his farewells and paddled off toward shore. He rode and rode, and finally saw the distant towers of a castle rising beside the lake. The towers reached even higher as he neared shore, until he realized that this must be the greatest castle in all the world. Harrenhal, Bran knew at once. It was Harrenhal.
Mira smiled.
Was it? Beneath its walls he saw tents of many colors, bright banners cracking in the wind, and knights in mail and plate on bartered horses. He smelled roasting meats, and heard the sound of laughter and the blare of heralds' trumpets. A great tourney was about to commence, and champions from all over the land had come to contest it. The king himself was there, with his son, the Dragon Prince. The White Swords had come to welcome a new brother to their ranks. The Storm Lord was on hand, and the Rose Lord as well. The great Lion of the Rock had quarreled with the king and stayed away, but many of his bannermen and knights attended all the same. The Crannog Man had never seen such pageantry, and knew he might never see the like again. Part of him wanted nothing so much as to be part of it.
Bran knew that feeling well enough. When he'd been little, all he ever dreamed of was being a knight, but that had been before he fell and lost his legs.
The daughter of the great castle reigned as queen of love and beauty when the tourney opened. Five champions had sworn to defend her crown, her four brothers of Harrenhal, and her famous uncle, a white knight of the king's guard. Was she a fair maid? Oh, she was, said Mira, hopping over a stone. But there were others, fairer still. One was the wife of the Dragon Prince, who brought a dozen lady companions to attend her. The knights all begged them for favors to tie about their lances.
Oh, this isn't going to be one of those love stories, is it? Bran asked suspiciously. Hodor doesn't like those so much.
Hodor, said Hodor agreeably.
He likes the stories where the knights fight monsters.
Sometimes the knights are the monsters, Bran. The little Crannog Man was walking across the fields, enjoying the warm spring day and harming none, when he was set upon by three squires. They were none older than 15, yet even so they were bigger than him, all three. This was their world, as they saw it, and he had no right to be there. They snatched away his spear and knocked him to the ground, cursing him for a frog-eater.
Were they Walders?
It sounded like something little Walder Frey might have done.
None offered a name, but he marked their faces well so he could revenge himself upon them later. They shoved him down every time he tried to rise, and kicked him when he curled up on the ground. But then they heard a roar. "That's my father's man you're kicking," howled the she-wolf.
"A wolf on four legs or two?"
"Two," said Mira. The she-wolf laid into the squires with a tourney sword, scattering them all. The Crannog Man was bruised and blooded, so she took him back to her lair to clean his cuts and bind them up with linen. There he met her pack brothers, the wild wolf who led them, the quiet wolf beside him, and the pup who was the youngest of the four. That evening there was to be a feast in Harrenhal to mark the opening of the tourney, and the she-wolf insisted that the lad attend. He was of high birth, with as much a right to a place on the bench as any other man. She was not easy to refuse, this wolf maid, so he let the young pup find him garb suitable to a king's feast, and went up to the great castle. Under Harren's roof he ate and drank with the wolves, and many of their sworn swords besides, barrow-down men, and moose, and bears, and mermen. The Dragon Prince sang a song so sad it made the wolf maid sniffle. But when her pup brother teased her for crying, she poured wine over his head. A black brother spoke, asking the knights to join the night's watch. The Storm Lord drank down the Knight of Skulls and Kisses in a wine-cup war. The Crannog man saw a maid with laughing purple eyes dance with a white sword, a red snake, and the Lord of Griffins, and lastly with a quiet wolf. But only after the wild wolf spoke to her on behalf of a brother too shy to leave his bench. Amidst all this merriment, the little Crannog man spied the three squires who'd attacked him. One served a pitchfork knight, one a porcupine, whilst the last attended a knight with two towers on his surcoat, a sigil all Crannog men know well.
"The phrase," said Bran, "the phrase of the crossing."
"Then as now," she agreed. "The wolf maid saw them too and pointed them out to her brothers. I could find you a horse and some armor that might fit," the pup offered. The little Crannog man thanked him, but gave no answer. His heart was torn. Crannog men are smaller than most, but just as proud. The lad was no knight, no more than any of his people. We sit a boat more often than a horse, and our hands are made for oars, not lances. Much as he wished to have his vengeance, he feared he would only make a fool of himself and shame his people. The quiet wolf had offered the little Crannog men a place in his tent at night, but before he slept, he knelt on the lake shore, looking across the water to where the Isle of Faces would be, and said a prayer to the old gods of North and Neck.
"You never heard this tale from your father?" asked Jojen.
"It was old Nan who told the stories. Mira, go on. You can't stop there."
Hodor must have felt the same. "Hodor," he said, and then, "Hodor, Hodor, Hodor, Hodor."
"Well," said Mira, "if you would hear the rest, yes, tell it." 5 days of jousting were planned," she said. "There was a great seven-sided melee as well, an archery and axe-throwing, a horse-race and tourney of singers."
"Never mind about all that," Bran squirmed impatiently in his basket on Hodor's back. "Tell about the jousting."
"As my prince commands, the daughter of the castle was a queen of love and beauty, with four brothers and an uncle to defend her, but all four sons of Harrenhal were defeated on the first day. The conquerors reigned briefly as champions until they were vanquished in turn. As it happens, the end of the first day saw the Porcupine Knight win a place among the champions, and on the morning of the second day, the Pitchfork Knight and the Knight of the Two Towers were victorious as well. But late on the afternoon of that second day, as the shadows grew long, a mystery knight appeared in the lists."
Bran nodded sagely. Mystery knights would often appear at tourneys, with helms concealing their faces and shields that were either blank or bore some strange device. Sometimes they were famous champions in disguise. The Dragon Knight once won a tourney as the Knight of Tears, so he could name his sister the Queen of Love and Beauty in place of the King's mistress. And Barristan the Bold twice donned a Mystery Knight's armour, the first time when he was only 10.
"It was a little Crannog man, I bet." "No one knew," said Mira, "but the Mystery Knight was short of stature and clad in ill-fitting armour made up of bits and pieces. The device upon his shield was a heart tree of the old gods, a white weirwood with a laughing red face."
"Maybe he came from the Isle of Faces," said Bran. "Was he green?" In old Nan's stories, the guardians had dark green skin and leaves instead of hair. Sometimes they had antlers, too. But Bran didn't see how the Mystery Knight could have worn a helm if he had antlers.
"I'll bet the old gods sent him." "Perhaps they did. The Mystery Knight dipped his lance before the king and rode to the end of the lists where the five champions had their pavilions. You know the three he challenged? The Porcupine Knight, the Pitchfork Knight, and the Knight of the Twin Towers.
Bran had heard enough stories to know that.
He was the little Crannog man, I told you. Whoever he was, the old gods gave strength to his arm. The Porcupine Knight fell first, then the Pitchfork Knight, and lastly the Knight of the Two Towers.
None were well-loved, so the common people cheered lustily for the Knight of the Laughing Tree, as the new champion soon was called. When his fallen foes sought to ransom horse and armor, the Knight of the Laughing Tree spoke in a booming voice through his helm, saying, "Teach your squire honor, that shall be ransom enough." Once the defeated knights chastised their squire sharply, their horses and armor returned, and so the little Crannog man's prayer was answered. By the green men, or the old gods, or the children of the forest, who can say?
It was a good story, Bran decided, after thinking about it a moment or two. Then what happened? Did the Knight of the Laughing Tree win the tourney and marry a princess?
No, said Mira. That night, at the great castle, the Storm Lord and the Knight of Skulls and Kisses each swore they would unmask him, and the king himself urged men to challenge him, declaring that the face behind the helm was no friend of his. But the next morning, when the heralds blew their trumpets and the king took his seat, only two champions appeared. The Knight of the Laughing Tree had vanished. The king was wroth, and even sent his son, the Dragon Prince, to seek the man, but all they ever found was his painted shield hanging abandoned in a tree. It was the Dragon Prince who won that tourney in the end.
Oh, Bran thought about the tale a while. That was a good story, but it should have been the three bad knights who hurt him, not their squires. Then the little Crannog man could have killed them all. The part about the ransoms was stupid, and the mystery knight should win the tourney, defeating every challenger, and name the wolf maid the Queen of Love and Beauty.
She was, said Mira, but that's a sadder story. Are you certain you never heard this tale before, Bran? Asked Jojen. Your lord father never told it to you?
Bran shook his head. The day was growing old by then, and long shadows were creeping down the mountainsides to send black fingers through the pines.
If the little Crannog man could visit the Isle of Faces, maybe I could too.
All the tales agreed that the green men had strange magic powers. Maybe they could help him walk again,
even turn him into a knight.
They turned the little Crannog man into a knight,
even if it was only for a day, he thought. A day would be enough.
Davos. The cell was warmer than any cell had a right to be. It was dark, yes. Flickering orange light fell through the ancient iron bars from the torch in the sconce on the wall outside, but the back half of the cell remained drenched in gloom. It was dank as well, as might be expected on an isle such as Dragonstone, where the sea was never far, and there were rats, as many as any dungeon could expect to have, and a few more besides. But Davos could not complain of chill. The smooth stony passages beneath the great mass of Dragonstone were always warm, and Davos had often heard it said they grew warmer the farther down one went. He was well below the castle, he judged, and the wall of his cell often felt warm to his touch when he pressed a palm against it. Perhaps the old tales were true, and Dragonstone was built with the stones of hell. He was sick when they first brought him here. The cough that had plagued him since the battle grew worse, and a fever took hold of him as well. His lips broke with blood blisters, and the warmth of the cell did not stop his shivering.
"I will not linger long," he remembered thinking. "I will die soon, here in the dark."
Davos soon found that he was wrong about that, as about so much else. Dimly he remembered gentle hands and a firm voice, and young Maester Pylos looking down on him. He was given hot garlic broth to drink, and milk of the poppy to take away his aches and shivers. The poppy made him sleep, and while he slept, they leeched him to drain off the bad blood, or so he surmised by the leech marks on his arms when he woke. Before very long the coughing stopped, the blisters vanished, and his broth had chunks of whitefish in it
and carrots and onions as well. And one day he realized that he felt stronger than he had since Black Betha shattered beneath him and flung him into the river. He had two jailers to tend him. One was broad and squat, with thick shoulders and huge strong hands. He wore a leather brigantine dotted with iron studs, and once a day brought Davis a bowl of oaten porridge. Sometimes he sweetened it with honey or poured in a bit of milk. The other jailer was older, stooped and sallow, with greasy, unwashed hair and pebble skin. He wore a doublet of white velvet with a ring of stars worked upon the breast in golden thread. It fit him badly, being both too short and too loose, and was soiled and torn besides. He would bring Davis plates of meat and mash, or fish stew, and once even half a lamprey pie. The lamprey was so rich he could not keep it down, but even so it was a rare treat for a prisoner in a dungeon. Neither sun nor moon shone in the dungeons. No windows pierced the thick stone walls. The only way to tell day from night was by his jailers. Neither man would speak to him, though he knew there were no mutes. Sometimes he heard them exchange a few brusque words as the watch was changing. They would not even tell him their names, so he gave them names of his own. The short, strong one he called Porridge, the stooped, sallow one, Lamprey, for the pie. He marked the passage of days by the meals they brought, and by the changing of the torches in the sconce outside his cell. A man grows lonely in the dark, and hungers for the sound of a human voice. Davis would talk to the jailers whenever they came to his cell, whether to bring him food or change his slops pail. He knew they would be deaf to pleas for freedom or mercy. Instead, he asked them questions, hoping perhaps one day one might answer.
"What news of the war?" he asked. "And is the king well?"
He asked after his son Devon, and the Princess Shireen, and Salador San.
"What is the weather like?" he asked, and "have the autumn storms begun yet? Do ships still sail the narrow sea?"
It made no matter what he asked, they never answered. Although sometimes Porridge gave him a look, and for half a heartbeat Davis would think he was about to speak. With Lamprey there was not even that much.
"I am not a man, Dim," Davis thought, "only a stone that eats and shits and speaks."
He decided after a while that he liked Porridge much the better. Porridge at least seemed to know he was alive, and there was a queer sort of kindness to the man. Davis suspected that he fed the rats. That was why there were so many. Once he thought he heard the jailer talking to them, as if they were children. But perhaps he'd only dreamed that.
"They do not mean to let me die," he realized. "They are keeping me alive for some purpose of their own."
He did not like to think what that might be. Lord Sunglass had been confined in the cells beneath Dragonstone for a time, as had Sir Hubbard Rampton's sons. All of them had ended on the pyre.
"I should have given myself to the sea," Davis thought, as he sat staring at the torch beyond the bars. "Or let the sail pass me by to perish on my rock. I would sooner feed crabs and flames."
Then one night, as he was finishing his supper, Davis felt a queer flush come over him. He glanced up through the bars, and there she stood, in shimmering scarlet, with her great ruby at her throat, her red eyes gleaming as bright as the torch that bathed her.
"Melisande," he said,
with a calm he did not feel.
"Onion night,"
she replied, just as calmly, as if the two of them had met on a stair or in the yard and were exchanging polite greetings.
"Are you well?" "Better than I was." "Do you lack for anything?" "My king, my son, I lack for them."
He pushed the bowl aside and stood.
"Have you come to burn me?"
Her strange red eyes studied him through the bars.
"This is a bad place, is it not? A dark place and foul. The good sun does not shine here, nor the bright moon."
She lifted a hand toward the torch in the wall sconce.
"This is all that stands between you and the darkness, Onion Knight. This little fire, this gift of R'hllor. Shall I put it out?"
"No."
He moved towards the bars.
"Please."
He did not think he could bear that, to be left alone in utter blackness, with no one but the rats for company. The red woman's lips curved upward in a smile.
"So, you have come to love the fire, it would seem."
"I need the torch."
His hands opened and closed.
"I will not beggar, I will not. I am like this torch," said Evers. "We are both instruments of R'hllor. We were made for a single purpose, to keep the darkness at bay. Do you believe that?"
"No."
Perhaps he should have lied and told her what she wanted to hear, but Davos was too accustomed to speaking truth.
"You are the mother of darkness. I saw that under Storm's End, when you gave birth before my eyes."
"Is the brave Sir Onions so frightened of a passing shadow? Take heart, then. Shadows only live when given birth by light. And the king's fires burn so low, I dare not draw off any more to make another son. It might well kill him."
Melisande moved closer.
"With another man, though. A man whose flames still burn hot and high. If you truly wish to serve your king's cause, come to my chamber one night. I could give you pleasure such as you have never known. And with your life fire, I could make
a horror." Davos retreated from her. "I want no part of you, my lady, or your god. May the Seven protect me."
Melisande sighed.
"They did not protect Gunther Sunglass. He prayed thrice each day, and bore seven-pointed stars upon his shield. But when R'hllor reached out his hand, his prayers turned to screams, and he burned. Why cling to these false gods?"
"I have worshipped them all my life."
"All your life, Davos Seaworth. As we'll say, it was so yesterday." She shook her head sadly. "You have never feared to speak the truth to kings. Why do you lie to yourself? Open your eyes, Sir Knight."
"What is it you would have me see?"
"The way the world is made. The truth is all around you, plain to behold. The night is dark and full of terrors, the day bright and beautiful and full of hope. One is black, the other white. There is ice, and there is fire, hate and love, bitter and sweet, male and female, pain and pleasure, winter and summer, evil and good."
She took a step toward him.
"Death and life, everywhere opposites, everywhere the war."
"The war?" asked Davos.
"The war," she affirmed. "There are two, Onion Knight. Not seven, not one, not 100 or 1,000, two. Do you think I cross half the world to put yet another vain king on yet another empty throne? The war has been waged since time began, and before it is done, all men must choose where they will stand. On one side is R'hllor, the Lord of Light, the Heart of Fire, the god of flame and shadow. Against him stands the great other, whose name may not be spoken, the lord of darkness, the soul of ice, the god of night and terror. Ours is not a choice between Baratheon and Lannister, between Greyjoy and Stark. It is death we choose, or life, darkness or light."
She clasped the bars of his cell with her slender white hands. The great ruby at her throat seemed to pulse with its own radiance.
"So tell me, Sir Davos Seaworth, and tell me truly, does your heart burn with the shining light of R'hllor? Or is it black and cold and full of worms?
She reached through the bars and laid three fingers upon his breast, as if to feel the truth of him through flesh and wool and leather.
My art, Davos said slowly, is full of doubts.
Melisande sighed.
Ah, Davos, the good knight is honest to the last, even in his day of darkness. It is well you did not lie to me. I would have known. The other servants often hide black hearts in gaudy light. Sir R'hllor gives his priests the power to see through their falsehoods.
She stepped lightly away from the cell.
Why did you mean to kill me?
I will tell you, said Davos, if you will tell me who betrayed me.
It could only have been Salador San, and yet even now he prayed it was not so. The Red Woman laughed.
No one betrayed you, Onion Knight. I saw your purpose in my flames.
The flames? If you can see the future in these flames, how is it that we burned upon the Blackwater? You gave my sons to the fire. My sons, my ship, my men, all burning.
Melisande shook her head.
You wrong me, Onion Knight. Those were no fires of mine. Had I been with you, your battle would have had a different ending. But his grace was surrounded by unbelievers, and his pride proved stronger than his faith. His punishment was grievous, but he has learned from his mistake.
Were my sons no more than a lesson for a king, then?
Davos felt his mouth tighten.
It is night in your seven kingdoms now,
the Red Woman went on.
But soon the sun will rise again. The war continues, Davos Seaworth, and some will soon learn that even an ember in the ashes can still ignite a great blaze. The old maester looked at Stannis and saw only a man. You see a king. You are both wrong. He is the Lord's chosen, the warrior of fire. I have seen him leading the fight against the dark. I have seen it in the flames. The flames do not lie. Else you would not be here. It is written in prophecy as well. When the red star bleeds and the darkness gathers, Azor Ahai shall be born again amidst smoke and salt to wake dragons out of stone. The bleeding star has come and gone, and Dragonstone is the place of smoke and salt. Stannis Baratheon is Azor Ahai reborn.
Her red eyes blazed like twin fires and seemed to stare deep into his soul.
You do not believe me. You doubt the truth of R'hllor even now. Yet have served him all the same and will serve him again. I shall leave you here to think on all that I have told you, and because R'hllor is the source of all good, I shall leave the torch as well.
With a smile and a swirl of scarlet skirts, she was gone. Only her scent lingered after, that and the torch. Davos lowered himself to the floor of the cell and wrapped his arms about his knees. The shifting torchlight washed over him. Once Melisande's footsteps faded away, the only sound was the scrabbling of rats.
Ice and fire, he thought, black and white, dark and light.
Davos could not deny the power of her guard. He had seen the shadow crawling from Melisande's womb, and the priestess knew things she had no way of knowing.
She saw my purpose in her flames.
It was good that Sala had not sold him, but the thought of the Red Woman spying out his secrets with her fires disquieted him more than he could say.
And what did she mean when she said that I had served her God and would serve him again?
He did not like that either. He lifted his eyes to stare up at the torch. He looked for a long time, never blinking,
watching the flames shift and shimmer. He tried to see beyond them, to peer beyond the fiery curtain and glimpse whatever lived back there. But there was nothing, only fire, and after a time his eyes began to water. God blind and tired, Davis curled up on the straw and gave himself to sleep. 3 days later, well, porridge had come thrice and lamprey twice, Davis heard voices outside his cell. He sat up at once, his back to the stone wall, listening to the sounds of struggle. This was new, a change in his unchanging world. The noise was coming from the left, where the steps led up to daylight. He could hear a man's voice, pleading and shouting. "Madness!" the man was saying as he came into view, dragged along between two guardsmen with fiery hearts on their breasts. Porridge went before them, jangling a ring of keys, and Sir Axel Florent walked behind. "Axel," the prisoner asked desperately, "for the love you bear me, unhand me. You cannot do this. I'm no traitor." He was an older man, tall and slender, with silvery grey hair, a pointed beard, and a long, elegant face, twisted in fear. "Where is Selyse? Where is the Queen? I demand to see her. The others take you all. Release me." The guards paid no mind to his outcries. "Here?" Porridge asked in front of the cell. Davis got to his feet. For an instant he considered trying to rush them when the door was open, but that was madness. There were too many. The guards wore swords, and Porridge was strong as a bull. Sir Axel gave the jailer a curt nod. "Let the traitors enjoy each other's company."
"I am no traitor,"
screeched the prisoner as Porridge was unlocking the door. Though he was plainly dressed in grey wool doublet and black breeches, his speech marked him as high-born.
"His birth will not serve him here," thought Davis.
Porridge swung the bars wide. Sir Axel gave a nod, and the guards flung their charge in headlong. The man stumbled and might have fallen, but Davis caught him. At once he wrenched away and staggered back toward the door, only to have it slammed in his pale, pampered face.
"No!" he shouted. "No!"
All the strength suddenly left his legs, and he slid slowly to the floor, clutching at the iron bars. Sir Axel, Porridge, and the guards had already turned to leave.
"You cannot do this!"
the prisoner shouted at their retreating backs.
"I am the King's hand!"
It was then that Davis knew him.
"You are Alastair Florent."
The man turned his head.
"Who?"
"Sir Davis Seaworth."
Lord Alastair blinked.
"Seaworth? The Onion Knight? You tried to murder Melisande."
Davis did not deny it.
"At Storm's End, you wore red gold armor with inlaid lapis flowers on your breastplate."
He reached down a hand to help the other man to his feet. Lord Alastair brushed the filthy straw from his clothing.
I must apologize for my appearance, sir. My chests were lost when the Lannisters overran our camp. I escaped with no more than the mail on my back and the rings on my fingers."
"He still wears those rings," noted Davis, who had lacked even all of his fingers.
"No doubt some cook's boy or groom is prancing around King's Landing just now in my slashed velvet doublet and jewelled cloak,"
Lord Alastair went on, oblivious.
"But war has its horrors, as all men know. No doubt you have suffered your own losses."
"My ship," said Davis, "all my men, four of my sons."
"Oh, may the Lord of Light lead them through the darkness to a better world," the other man said.
"May the Father judge them justly, and the Mother grant them mercy,"
Davis thought, but he kept his prayer to himself. The Seven had no place on Dragonstone now.
"My own son is safe at Brightwater," the Lord went on, "but I lost a nephew on the Fury, Sir Emry, my brother Ryan's son."
It had been Sir Emry Florent who led them blindly up the Blackwater Rush, with all oars pulling, paying no heed to the small stone towers at the mouth of the river. Davis was not like to forget him.
My son Marek was your nephew's oarmaster.
He remembered his last sight of fury engulfed in wildfire.
Has there been any word of survivors?
The fury burned and sank with all hands.